funeral food. So good for your soul, fills you up down to your toes. We sure eat good when someone dies. How many people can identify with that? How many people have found a moment of savory comforts amidst a sadly uncomfortable moment? When it's hard to imagine, much less face what's next in life, sometimes it helps to be handed a plate of something familiar, something that nourishes our soul. For some, at the end of our rope, it can feel like returning to a time that was hopeful, a time when everything was new. This homily is about comfort and our need to feel it and our ability to offer it. It's about getting our feet back on the ground when we've been upended by life. It's about losing our place when the story we thought we were telling, that we were right in the middle of, gets an unexpected rewrite. And the door to the happily ever after that we thought we were headed towards closes. It's a homily about helping find and offering new beginnings. In 1997, I did a year-long residency as a chaplain at Toronto General Hospital. In my first week, I was put on the on-call schedule, and the very first night of that on-call, I was paged to the ICU. Car accident. A Filipino man named Mangayo, known as Manny, young, on life support, not expected to live. The family was gathering. It was my first call. I'd never done anything like this before, and I felt horribly unprepared, but I grabbed the on-call booklet with the readings and the prayers, and I went. And when I arrived there in the waiting room were 20 people, mostly silent, many holding tissues, crying. And I introduced myself. "Thank God," someone said, "the chaplain's here," which only added to my feeling of inadequacy. "We're a very religious family," she continued. "Can you pray with us?" she asked. Unitarians don't have a lot of training in prayer. Let me just explain that, going through seminary. So I looked down at the booklet I had in my hand, and on the first page was the verse from the book of John, the one you might be familiar with. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." And I read that, and I felt my brain come to a screeching halt. I had heard this passage countless times before, but what did it mean? What did it have to do with this tragedy? And what did it have to do with this life hanging in the balance, or all of those hanging on with it? I wasn't sure what to say. I knew this was scripture, that it might offer some comfort and reassurance for a family that was very religious, but I had only really associated this as an evangelical passage. And this felt like a time of great tragedy and tenderness and vulnerability, not a time to convert anyone or to preach. So I paused for what seemed like an eternity. What do you say in these situations, moments where you find yourself in the midst of pain so palpable that words seem impotent, where you know that nothing you can say will fix it or explain it, and you can't erase or escape the pain that someone is feeling? What can be said? UU minister Kate Braestrup wrote a book in 2010 called Beginner's Grace, and it's a primer on real prayer for real life. It talks about prayer not as a recitation of other people's ancient words, but what the most tender parts of our heart might say when it feels most broken. Braestrup, you'd have to believe, was someone who could speak that language because she experienced the need for it. In 1996, she was a part-time writer and a full-time mother of four children and married to Drew Griffith. In addition to serving as a Maine state trooper, Drew was studying for the UU ministry, hoping to become a police chaplain. And one early April morning, Drew left for work and everything changed. On the very roads that he protected every day, an oncoming driver lost control and Kate lost her husband. In those early moments after the accident, trying to hold it together, she had two strangers come knocking at her door. In her book, this newly widowed mother of four young children remembers what happened next. She writes, "Perhaps 40 minutes after I had heard the news of Drew's death, I was sitting in the living room with my friend Monica when the doorbell rang. I was on the phone with the sergeant, so Monica sprang to answer it. And there stood a young man on the front steps, clad in a spiffy dark suit, his hair neatly combed, exuding a scent of soap and virtue. He beamed at Monica with a wide smile. 'Have you heard the good news?' he said. And for a long second, Monica glared at him, not sure whether to punch him or to laugh hysterically. So she compromised by slamming the door." The story explains why it is sometimes hard for us to answer the door in our times of grief and doubt, depression, or confusion. When we're in pain, when we've felt great betrayal or have been brokenhearted by life, when our hopes and dreams have been trampled, it is sometimes hard to believe that good news will show up for us. There is a fear that we will encounter those who are not there for our needs or hopes or fears, but simply to impose their own upon us. And if that's all we can expect when asked to open the door, I would never recommend it. But it can be different, very different. Kate Braestrup's story continues. "A few minutes later, the doorbell rang again. This time I answered it. It was my neighbor, an elderly woman who I had exchanged no more than a dozen words with in the 10 years that we lived in Maine. She had potholders on her hands which held a pan of brownies that were still hot from the oven, and tears were rolling down her cheeks. 'I just heard,' she said. And then she just silently held out the brownies. My neighbor was the leading edge of a tsunami of food that continued for many months after Drew's death. I didn't know neighbors would come to feed us, that men would drywall the playroom, build bookshelves, mow the lawn, change the oil in my car. I didn't know that my house would be cleaned, my story would be listened to, and that I would not be abandoned to the labor of mourning alone. All I knew was that my neighbor was standing on the front stoop with her brownies and her tears. She was the good news." The hardest moments in life are when someone dies. It can be a parent or a partner, it can be a sibling or a friend or neighbor, someone who had a place in our life as the holder of confidences or who understood and accepted and shared our dreams. It can be a pet, especially if that pet brought us unconditional affection and abiding love through the twists and turns of life. But our hardest moments don't always come from a loss of life. Sometimes what brings us to our knees is news of a different loss, loss of a job, or of a home, a goal, or even a clear direction. It might be a loss of our health when we receive a diagnosis, or the loss of financial security to be able to provide for those depending on us. Whatever it is, the plan or the story that we were trying to tell, that we were right in the middle of, is changed, and a frightening uncertainty creeps in. Our next steps, even our imagination, becomes palsied by fear, and it seems hard to continue without some good news to jumpstart us out of our paralysis or at least make sure we aren't left to struggle alone. As the 20 people gathered in the waiting room looked at me, they waited for me to speak, and I stared down at my scripture. I thought I should read it. After all, I was the chaplain. But for the life of me, I had no idea what I would say after I finished that. So I didn't read that. Instead, I turned to the woman who asked me to pray and everyone else looking on and asked, "Tell me about Manny." The woman that I talked to, Manny's sister, started awkwardly, and I learned from her that he was driving home from his job as a restaurant manager where he had worked his way up from dishwasher. He was going to school, he was married, he had two children. And then others joined in. I learned that his name was actually Mangoya, which meant playful in Tagalog, and that it was the perfect name for him. I learned that he was Catholic and that his mother wanted him to become a priest, but he fell in love with the woman who then became his wife. I learned that their whole family lived within four blocks of one another, and everyone helped take care of everyone else. I learned that he was studying to become an EMT, that he liked to help people. I heard stories about how he was definitely not very handy at fixing things, especially plumbing, whereupon everyone laughed together about a well-celebrated inside joke. I heard he had a huge heart, and he was always the first one in line to take food over to cousins or neighbors. What started soft and slow grew until almost everyone chimed in and shared something about Manny. There was laughter, but there were more tears and occasionally weeping. And when the pain of that reality came poignantly back for somebody, they were surrounded by others with a hand on their shoulder or a tissue to cry into. I mostly just listened, occasionally asking questions to keep the conversation going. But after an hour, it seemed like the grief had exhausted everyone, so I asked if I could pray. And I simply just tried to name all the things about Manny that I could remember being shared, his playfulness as well as his dreams, and how over time what he'd shared became unquestionable kind of love, even in times where there were great questions. Besides the prayer, I really didn't say much, but they all thanked me, and when I left, they called me Father, which surprised me. I didn't even feel very chaplain-y. In supervision the next day, I shared my experience with my supervisor and the other chaplains, and I confessed my terror when I arrived and the feelings of inadequacy and helplessness that I had and the shame of not knowing what to say. I told them how I couldn't bring myself to read that piece of scripture. My supervisor responded by explaining that scripture to me in a way that I could understand. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He pointed out that Word is actually translated from the Greek logos, which could as easily have been translated as reasoning or meaning, but he preferred the translation of story. In the beginning was the story. And then because I was Unitarian Universalist, and he was Baptist, and he liked to tease me, he challenged me to retranslate the word God. I guess it means love. Okay, so what do you have? In the beginning was the story, and the story was with love, and the story was love. And then it clicked. Each of us at one time or another experiences loss. And when that loss feels so great, it feels like we lose our inherent connection to love and to life, and we sometimes can't get started again. We can't remember how our own story goes. We lose our voice, our own narrative. And he pointed out that what I had done when I walked in that room was actually to help get that family jump-started back into their story, a story which includes loss, but it's not ultimately about loss. Their story is about love. That's what happened with Kate Braestrup seeing the woman with the brownies and the tears. The brownies in that moment were not the good news. It was the woman whose tears validated the depth of the loss. She was the good news. Her job was not to fix Kate's dilemma or replace it with her own story. Her job was simply to help Kate rediscover her place in her own story. Without her husband, she didn't know where that would be, and it would take some time and painful soul searching and maybe more than one pan of brownies. That is what we are all here to do with one another. You don't have to be a pastor. You don't have to know scripture or speak Greek. You don't have to train in a hospital. You simply have to be willing to do what my supervisor asked us every day he sent us out onto the floor. He said, "Go be helpless with them." And then he would follow, "And this time, try not to be too helpful. That just gets in the way." And he would always say, "Try not to be right. Being right and being righteous is often the enemy of empathy, which is what we all need when we lose our way." Here at Brew, you can sign up to be on the Brownie Brigade, or you can provide rides or contribute to the relief fund of those affected by the shutdown. But the real work that we are called to do is as a central caregiver, is what Nell Morton names. And she says, simply listen them into their truth again. Friends, you are all, we are all, in a great story together. The story is with love, and the story is love. At one time or another, each of you will be the one who loses your place, and at one time or another, each of you can be the good news which helps someone else reclaim their story and rediscover their way to the glory of life.